Hi, friend. Welcome to Holly's Highlights, a podcast designed to encourage, inspire, and equip you to intentionally live your life full of purpose. I'm your host, Holly Kirby, motivational speaker, leadership cultivator, marketing strategist, and personal cheerleader. Let's check out today's highlight. This episode brought to you by Plexus. Plexus is on the cutting edge of health science, with a range of products focused on every aspect of your health and happiness. We help your body get rid of the bad stuff, pave the way for better digestive health, and feed your system to benefit the body and mind. Our goal is to make products that are the highest quality, non-GMO, 100% vegetarian, and gluten-free wherever possible. Most importantly, Plexus products work. They're all for health, so there's health for all. For more information, contact Senior Gold Ambassador Megan Kess at megan.kess@gmail.com. That's megan.kess@gmail.com. We all know that the start of a new year brings a common resolution of lose weight, but it looks like COVID may have an impact on that too. According to CNN, some people have gained an average of 1.5 pounds each month during this pandemic. So looking at weight and healthy eating and the like are even more of a common talk these days. In honor of National Health Month and due to these added concerns of eating healthy, we have Ariel Silicky joining us today to help us out a bit when it comes to how to make a good healthy choice moving forward. Ariel is nationally recognized health optimization expert, functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner, so FDNP, and San Francisco's premier longevity-focused personal trainer. She works with high-achieving professionals around the globe to identify and address the root causes of their burnout and their chronic exhaustion using lab testing and implementing science-based holistic strategies to achieve peak performance as well as exceptional and lasting health outcomes. Ariel's passion for her craft is rooted in 7 years of experience working in all sectors of the health and wellness space, and along with a genuine desire to help her clients find joy and meaning in the lifelong pursuit of their optimal health potential. Welcome, Ariel. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Holly. Thank you so much for inviting me to come on and chat with you. I am so excited.
Yay. Well, Ariel, we have so many questions, as you and I were talking about earlier, so we're just going to dive right in. And I'll be honest, the forefront of my mind is water. I feel like I am constantly drinking water. So how much is enough? Is it that half the body weight, 8 ounces of glasses? Can you help narrow that down for us?
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. And water, you know, I think that the general rule of thumb for hydration is getting, you know, half your body weight in ounces of water. So let's say you are 150 pounds, you want to aim for 75 ounces of water per day. That can come from straight up water, or it can also come from the fruits and vegetables that you're having. Most of the food that we eat contains some amount of water. So it doesn't have to just be, you know, you're looking at however many glasses that comprises your 75 ounces. So yeah, water is super, super important. It's really one of the main things that we can do to help our bodies naturally detoxify. Our body has a super robust detoxification mechanism, including, you know, our skin and our kidneys and our lungs and our gut and our liver, and all these organs need water in order to help us detoxify naturally. So, you know, and dehydration can lead to digestive problems and constipation and overly acidic stomach and all kinds of other things. So yeah, water is super, super important.
Now, I know for at least my team at work, we'll sit around the table at our staff meeting and one person will have like a supplement to put in their water and another one a powder packet and someone else a flavoring packet. So is it just straight up water? Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fruit and vegetables, but are we okay adding those energy powders and flavorings into our water, or does that negate the ounces that we're drinking?
Well, you know, I'm glad that you're asking that, because it's not like a powder could negate the drinking of water, but certainly what's important to note here is what actually is contained in those different powders. There's lots of hidden sweeteners that we can be ingesting in those powders, or artificial flavors or stabilizers or different things purporting to be electrolyte blends or whatever it is. So my kind of rule of thumb is always that you want to get your micronutrients and macronutrients from whole food sources. So if you're taking something in a powder form, it's important to look at why you're doing that. If it's really just a matter of, oh, I really just don't like the taste of plain water, which I know as a kid, that was a big thing for me. I just could, my parents could not get me to drink straight up water. And so if you're like me with that, you know, I really like to have decaffeinated tea. Right now I'm looking at my desk. I have like 17 different kinds of tea, different, you know, in packets or loose leaf. And that gets really fun just to kind of go to the bulk section and find different teas that smell interesting or that sound interesting. And or even to cut up different fruits or things like that and infuse your water with those. So that would be my recommendation over doing kind of nebulous powders or things like that to water, because those can just be a little bit sneaky.
Okay. And what about lemons? How does that play into all of this?
Yeah, lemon, I would say, is another way that you can kind of enhance the taste of your water. There is some science and literature that suggests that something that's acidic, like lemon or apple cider vinegar added to your water, can help with digestion or can help with the clarity of your skin or things like that. But of course, for every person who benefits from something like that, there will always be someone who doesn't necessarily benefit very much because it's too acidic, or, you know, it gives them acid reflux, or it harms the enamel of the tooth or things like that. So as with most things, and you'll probably hear this as a recurring theme as we speak today, but my answer will often be, it depends.
Yeah. Along that, it depends on what you're drinking, it sounds like too. So as we go to my kid's doctor, when we go up to their annual doctor appointment, one of the questions is, you know, how many juices are you drinking a day, or how much milk are you drinking? Mm-hmm. And you hear getting the milk in for your bones and creating that healthy juices. Is it more the sweeteners that are in them? Is it just the juices that we shouldn't be drinking? How do other just drinks play into what we're consuming?
Well, a lot of the issue with juice, and it's not inherently that fruit is bad, but what happens when we are drinking just pure fruit juice, let's say, is that the juices, a lot of times, I should say, the juices are from concentrate. So it's really coming from something that's kind of moderately resembling the fruit, but it's not actually the fruit itself. There can be added flavors in there. But when you're taking a fruit juice, the main issue is that you are rendering that juice devoid of the fiber that helps to make it so that that fruit juice doesn't spike your blood sugar, which inherently that can be not ideal as far as health, just general health things are concerned. So if you're going to have a fruit juice, my recommendation is always to just have the whole fruit instead, because it will mitigate the blood sugar spike that comes as a result of having that fruit. And then as far as milk, it depends again on why you're drinking that milk. If you're drinking milk to be hydrated, there's lots of ways to get hydration rather than milk. We're actually the only mammals that continue to drink the milk of any animal, any mammal after our kind of infantile stage. The milk really is kind of a perfect growth elixir, really, because it has protein, it has carbs, and it has fat in it. And so depending to the source of the milk, we can be ingesting additional hormones and things like that. And that's not super great. So if you're trying to get calcium, I'd say, we may touch on this later, but there's definitely plenty of other ways to get calcium rather than from milk. As far as hydration goes, I think juices and milk, less than ideal. Certainly carbonated drinks and other flavored beverages are things to be used as treats rather than staples in a hydration ritual.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned teas, coffee. What about for just carbonation and caffeine in general? What are some of your feedbacks on keeping healthy there?
So caffeine is a stimulant. Many of us are familiar with caffeine by our just kind of everyday coffee ritual. We love coffee in this country, and, you know, the world actually just in general loves coffee. But for some people, it can be really addictive and can actually cause withdrawal. Caffeine can, anyway, and those withdrawal symptoms can be really pretty nasty. So if people are drinking coffee habitually, it's important to look into why they're feeling the need to drink their coffee? Is it the ritual? Is it that something nice and warm in their hand in the beginning of the day? They're really trying to understand the root of the desire to drink that coffee. Is it because they need more energy? My question then would naturally lead to, okay, well, why do you feel you need to start your day with caffeine? Do you feel your energy is lacking? What does the rest of your nutrition look like? What does your sleep look like? And caffeine as kind of a band-aid over fatigue is not necessarily the reason why we want to be drinking that coffee in the morning, because if we need it as an energy boost, that's merely just going to be a band-aid over our energy production issues. And we want to take a look at where that fatigue or where that just chronic tiredness or exhaustion is coming from, rather than kind of just putting a temporary band-aid over that symptom.
Now we've pretty much nailed drinks. Thank you so much. Now, what about eating? When it comes to eating, eat fruit, don't eat fruit. What's the verdict there?
Fruit is not inherently bad. I mean, not all sugar is created equal. The sugar that is added into, let's say, Coca-Cola is not the same as in a papaya or in a raspberry. And so when we're thinking about fruit, this can have different implications for our blood sugar, which we talked about just a moment ago. But generally, we want to keep our blood sugar as stable as possible. And that is going to make it so that we're not contributing to potentially increasing our insulin resistance, which can ultimately lead to type 2 diabetes or prediabetes or things like that. And as we know, type 2 diabetes is a big issue for us and obesity in this country. So I would say fruits, we want to, if prediabetes or diabetes or obesity is a concern for you, we want to be looking at having fruits lower on the glycemic index scale. So that means balancing the amount of carbohydrates to fiber. So fruits that meet that criterion tend to be kind of raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries too, guavas, passion fruit. These fruits are a lot higher in fiber. And so that works to kind of slow the digestive process down a little bit and doesn't spike our blood sugar as much. But for those of us who don't necessarily have concerns about being overweight or obese or developing type 2 diabetes or have that running in our family, that's not necessarily much of a concern, I would say. Of course, in moderation, though, we don't want to have a diet 100% comprised of fruits, of course, but it can certainly be a nice alternative for those of us who are like me, who have a big sweet tooth. Of course, having an apple or a persimmon, which are, you know, some of my favorites, is going to be better than having a big bowl of ice cream, let's say, or pie or like cookies or something like that. Right. But yeah, a lot of times it's thinking, you know, what is the healthier alternative? And certainly fruit is going to be a healthier alternative to many of our other favorite kind of more processed desserts.
Okay. Now, when we balance that with the vegetables, whether it be canned vegetables, fresh vegetables, frozen vegetables. We just went back to Missouri not too long ago. And back in the Midwest, you definitely eat vegetables there. There's no problem eating the vegetables because they're so good. But when it comes back to that nutritional value, is there a best way to get it, or does it matter between the canned or the fresh or the frozen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the consideration that we're taking into account when we're thinking about fresh versus frozen versus canned vegetables or anything really for that matter is the micronutrient density. So when and where was that vegetable picked? If you're getting something locally from the farmer's market that you know grows, you know, an hour or two away from where you locally live and is organic, that's going to be the most micronutrient dense vegetable that you can have. Sometimes though too, if a vegetable is flash frozen right after being picked, that's a great way to retain micronutrients in that vegetable as well. In canned veggies, I would say that would be my last choice, just because we don't know where, or rather how long those vegetables have been sitting on the shelf and things like that. Sometimes they can contain preservatives or other types of things, or be sitting in water or in cans that contain BPA, which isn't which is something that we should try and avoid. So I'd say if you're going to get your fresh vegetables, just paying attention to where they're coming from, if you can. A lot of times too, veggies are shipped from who knows even where, you know, across overseas, and fruits too, for that matter, coming from places where they're picked unripe and then they kind of ripen off the vine or off of their plant, which at that, you know, within that window between when they're picked and when we pick them up from the shelves, they have the tendency to start to lose the micronutrients in there. So the fresher that we can get it, the better, and the more locally we can get our vegetables too, the better, which I know you said Missouri, was it?
Yes.
You are getting. Yep. So I'm sure that you have just the best fresh veggies yes. there. And you can really taste the difference too.
Absolutely.
The vibrance, the color, and that really is indicative of how dense, nutritionally dense those vegetables are. So frozen or fresh, but just paying close attention to where those fresh veggies are coming from.
Okay. Now with our meats, I know not everyone likes to get their protein from meats. And for others, I just went out to lunch with my dad and he likes to order salmon when he goes out just to be able to get his fish intake. A trick that I try to use in some of mm-hmm. my recipes at home is instead of using the red meat, substitute it when I can and when I can get away with it with a ground turkey or something. So when it comes to those meats, what is one that we should lean toward? Any that we should avoid altogether, and what other sources of protein are out there for us for those who don't even want to be eating the meats?
Protein is such a huge topic of there's a lot of debate about whether animal meat is inherently bad for you, or red meat is something we should try and stay away from, or that it causes cancer, or all these things. But ultimately, protein is vital for all of us. We all need to be consuming some type of protein. Regardless of where that's coming from, protein is broken down into amino acids in the body, which are the building blocks for bones and skin and hair and nails and all of that, muscles, cartilage, all of that. So it's very, very important, super vital to be getting enough protein. What that means for different people, it depends. Again, if you're someone who's very active, or you participate in strength training, or you are older, or have a history of osteoporosis in your family or things like that, we need to adjust your protein needs accordingly. But there are lots of sources of protein. Meat and seafood definitely are the most obvious ones. You can get extra points for pasture raised or grass fed and finished and wild caught meat and seafood. Those are going to be, you know, reflective of the micronutrient density in those sources of protein. But if you're not eating meat or seafood, if you're vegetarian or vegan, you can still get protein from beans, grains, and legumes. If you are an omnivore, these also count as carbohydrates. So just taking that into account. But Greek yogurt also has protein, or cottage cheese, forms of dairy cheese. Definitely has some protein as well, and egg whites. So those are some my favorite sources of protein. Nutritional yeast too, for our vegans, that does have a good bit of protein in there. As I said, if you can get your meat from sources that you know, so avoiding highly processed meats like deli meats, or cured like salami or things like that, using that more as treats. And getting fresh, locally sourced, grass-fed, grass-finished, or wild-caught meat and seafood, those are going to be the sources that are best, quote-unquote, best for you if you choose to consume meat.
Okay. Now, what about some alternatives you mentioned with, instead of having like pie or a cookie or ice cream, to have that apple mm-hmm. to quench that sweet taste that you're wanting, or even salami you mentioned for a treat. So what are some other alternatives that you'd suggest when we're craving those things such as pizza and burgers and bags of chips and stuff? And along with that, when we do go out, especially going out to eat, how can we still stay healthy? What other alternative options are there? Like on pizza, you know, the cauliflower versus the regular crust. Walk us through some of those tips and tricks, if you would.
Well, yeah. So reading a menu at a restaurant can sometimes be tricky because we don't know always how those foods are being cooked, in what oils they're being cooked, or where they're sourcing their ingredients. So, you know, avoiding things that have more brown foods, that's to say, you know, like pastas or breads or things like that, and opting for more of the kind of deconstructed meals. So sometimes you'll see like a side of protein with a side of veggies with a side of some type of carbohydrate. And that's really how I like to teach my clients to structure their plates at home too, is to have some form of protein, some form of vegetable, non-starchy vegetable, some form of starchier vegetable or starch, you know, a grain or something like that as your form of carbohydrate, and then some form of healthy fat. So if you can try and kind of look at the menu to see things like entrees, usually they'll have the, you know, a steak entree with a side of fries or a side of vegetables, and then whatever, you know, a soup or some type of rice or potato or, you know, that. So you can be that kind of annoying person at the restaurant and just ask, you know, what, you know, just curious, you know, what are your alternatives, or is it possible to get a side of vegetables and things like that instead of fries? And usually they do have substitutions available, especially now. Nowadays, where people have so many dietary restrictions or food sensitivities, yeah, or allergies or things like that. But yeah, I would say as an alternative for desserts, let's say, usually they will offer kind of a seasonal fruit or something that has less in the way of a processed carb in there. So something fruit based. So even if it's kind of like cobbler or something like that, over like something that's higher in carb and fat, like a cheesecake or something like that, if you're looking at just overall lowering the caloric implications of the dessert or the food that you're having, since fat, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but fat, it has more than twice as much the caloric implication than protein and carbohydrates do. So if you're looking at just lowering the amount of calories, generally something that has more in the way of carbs and protein versus higher proportion of fat in there will, at the very least, lower the amount of calories. Yeah, it's tricky going out to restaurants and finding healthy options. But the best way is really just to kind of do your research before you go to a restaurant, take a look at the menu and see what kind of options are available.
Okay. Now, you just touched on something that I think is a perfect avenue to kind of tread down for a moment, and that is calories. So if we're trying to lose weight or just stabilize our weight, how many calories should we be consuming per day?
Again, this totally depends, and this is such a huge variable based on our level of activity in a given day, or based on our goals, if we're trying to gain weight, if we're trying to lose weight, how sedentary we are, whether we are participating in strength training, what our genetic predispositions are, all these things play into how many calories we should be having per day. And as we know, on a nutrition label, the FDA guidelines base everything on a 2,000 calorie diet, which many of us will be below that, and actually many of us will be above that. So that's just super general guideline. But I'd say that someone who is, you know, a female, females, like I say, tend to have lower caloric needs than males do. Depends so much that it's hard for me to give a guideline as far as how many calories to eat. And this is kind of where being aware, bringing awareness and intentionality to what and how you're eating is so important. Being in touch with your body's own hunger and satiety cues, and knowing when you're hungry, knowing when you're full, and understanding those things, and not mistaking thirst or boredom or anxiety for hunger, which is something that is easy to do, especially now when we're so hyper-stimulated, or many of us are working from home, or we are, especially during COVID, have a lot in question of lack of community or loneliness and things like that. It's easy to overeat when we're at home. So, yeah. And I don't actually recommend that my clients even count calories, because I just don't think that it's a sustainable method. And I teach my clients a different way of gauging how many calories they're eating using their hand, actually, different hand portions, because that is something, you know, your hand comes with you everywhere you go, and you're never going to bring a food scale with you to a restaurant or something like that to measure out how much you're having. And again, I just kind of think it takes some of the life and the joy out of eating when you're constantly thinking of food as a number rather than as the enjoyment of that food and the flavor and as fuel and nourishment for your body.
That's a great tip, using your hand. Now, is there a time frame that's best for eating? Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's lost a lot of weight because she doesn't start eating until 11 a.m. So she has that break fast. So what's that sweet spot to encourage mm-hmm. our body to lose weight?
I teach my clients to try and fit all of their calories within no more than a 12-hour eating window. So that means that if you start eating at 9 in the morning, you should definitely be done eating by 9 o'clock at night. Now, I encourage a little bit smaller of a time-restricted eating window for most people. And of course, everybody's goals are different. But when you do this, you help to kind of lean into your body's natural, what's called its circadian rhythm. And each of the organs in our body functions on its own circadian rhythm, including our stomach and our guts and, you know, our brain and our everything that produces hormones. And so when we can lean into when our body is naturally more optimized to be digesting and assimilating foods, that's going to make it easier and just our bodies to function the well-oiled machines that they are intended to function as. So I myself generally have a 15 or 16 hour eating window. So I almost never eat breakfast anymore. And I have, you know, generally I'll have my first meal of the day around noon, and I'll finish eating for the day around 8 p.m. So I'll have a lunch, and I'm generally like snacking a time or two in between lunch and dinner, and then I'll have a dinner around 7 or so. So that I would say would be my recommendation. There's lots of good resources out there for intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating. Dr. Sachin Panda is one, Dr. Peter Attia, Dr. Walter Longo, so much research and so many great resources out there for you. I would say, especially for women, be aware of how your cycle affects your hunger and satiety across, you know, the month. And there are different times within the month that we should be more wary of practicing our time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting, but certainly can be a really powerful tool for weight loss. And I use this as a tool with many of my clients, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, it used to be age and height that impacted our weight range. But I know as I'm pushing, just pushed over 40, now with my metabolism slowing down, I can definitely feel that. What are the healthy weight ranges that we should be looking at? And how do we determine that, especially with underlying health factors that come into play nowadays, as you mentioned, and family health history? What can we take from that and apply? And what do we need to realize is maybe older methods and not pay so much attention to?
Yeah. So much like the last question that you asked about how many calories we should really be having, there are definite calculators online that you can go on and do a basic calculation. But BMI is one of the measurements that we have traditionally used to assess healthy weight. That's our body mass index, basically is a ratio of our height to our weight. But that has, you know, largely become obsolete as a result of the fact that it doesn't take into account our lean muscle mass. So muscle mass weighs more than fat mass does. And so somebody who is really, really muscular could potentially be categorized in the obese category or overweight category according to BMI, but it's only because they have a really high amount of muscle mass. And so I don't like to gauge my clients' health based on BMI alone. There are other measurements, including waist to hip ratio, that are more telling in making sure that we are healthy in that. But definitely, I would say your waist to hip ratio. If your waist is larger than your hips, that probably is a good indicator that it's time to take a look at ways to decrease that waist to hip ratio.
Okay, now you mentioned our activity and what that looks like. And of course, it's all going to come back as we are learning more and more in all of this health talk that it depends. It depends on age and health and other factors. But on average, what should our activity or our exercise look like? How often and what kind or how long should we be exercising?
Yeah. So I was a personal trainer at Equinox for 2 years. And this is one of the favorite questions that people would ask me, you know, like, what's better, cardio or strength training and things like that. And I would say if you had to choose between cardiovascular training and strength training, you'd have to go with strength training, just because a lot of times people will see cardio for the wrong, will be leaning on cardio for the wrong reasons. If you're just doing cardio to burn an extra couple calories or two, your body is smarter than that. And so it's not going to let you just get away with that. There are plenty of ways to increase your caloric expenditure or decrease the amount of food that you're having to achieve that negative energy balance or taking in less calories than you expend, which inherently will cause you to lose weight just by the science of mass neither being created or destroyed and things like that. So if you had to choose exercise-wise, the best bang for your buck is to spend 30 minutes lifting something heavy and putting it down rather than just going for, you know, a run or something like that if your intention is to burn calories. Just because when you're strength training, you're building up lean muscle mass, which will raise your basal metabolic rate, because fat burns fewer calories at rest than muscle does. And so if you're trying to have the best long-term gain from the exercise that you do in a given moment, raising the amount of calories that you burn at rest in the long term is going to be better for you than just burning a spurt of calories just in a half an hour time span. However, I don't want to minimize the effect of training your heart and your lungs to be more efficient. And you can do that through strength training and also through cardiovascular training. So if it depends too, how much time you have in a given day. So many of my clients are very busy. They don't have time to go to the gym, or they don't have time or the resources to do strength training workouts. So in that case, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't work out. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't exercise. It just means that, okay, well, what can I do with the time that I do have? Do you have 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day? Go outside and get some vitamin D and fresh air and take a walk. Is that going to be better than nothing? Absolutely. Is that going to be better than strength training 30 minutes a day, three times a week? No, not necessarily, but just comes down to prioritization. And we all only have 24 hours in a day, right? So we have to figure out what rises to the top of our priority list.
Yeah. Now you mentioned with everyone's just kind of busy schedules, everyone has a different way that they use their 24 hours in a day. We get that. But for some listeners, they might be thinking, you know, I drink exactly as you guys are saying, and I eat foods that are on the good list, and I'm working out and I'm working on that losing the weight, and it's not coming off. And for some, they might find that it's the cortisol, just the stress of everyday life. How does that stress play into our weight gain? And what are some tips that we might be able to use to overcome that cortisol weight gain?
Yeah, this really does get into the crux of exactly what I do as an FDN practitioner. I really focus on working with people, high achieving people, specifically women who are just burned out, and they exercise, they're trying to do it all. Maybe they're working these long days, they wake up and no matter how much sleep they're getting, they're really just feeling depleted and exhausted. Even just waking up at first, you know, eyes opening and getting up out of the bed, they're just already exhausted. The body's stress response allows us to evolutionarily to run and flee from danger. And so stress inherently is not a bad thing. It's what's allowed us to survive over these, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. But it's when stress becomes chronic that becomes an issue, because we lose our ability to manipulate or get the best result from watching, you know, as our cortisol levels rise and fall. You're just kind of, your body's constantly pumping out cortisol because it thinks it's in a constant threatened state. So there are so many things that can be causing that heightened cortisol response, not just mental emotional stress, but also food sensitivities or lack of exercise or lack of sleep or the presence of pathogens, bacteria, yeast, fungal overgrowth and things like that, or digestive insufficiencies. So one of the things that I do with my clients is I run lab tests with them to see what are those stressors that are causing the body to not be able to properly engage, you know, pump out cortisol when times are stressful, and then kind of turn off that cortisol response when the parasympathetic nervous system or our rest and digest nervous system should be active. So I would say there's a ton of ways to look at this, you know, by removing our food sensitivities, by increasing the amount of sleep that we get, meditation, you know, tapping into play, doing things that bring us joy and just for the sake of doing those things. And that's how we can start to kind of recalibrate our body's stress response.
Okay. One of those meditation you mentioned, just getting out and being able to go for a simple walk, is soaking up that vitamin D, soaking up that sun. Are there any other vitamins or even supplements that you would recommend for us taking? Again, I realize that it depends on age, lifestyle, different health issues, but are there any that you're like, you know what, in addition to getting out in the sun and soaking up that vitamin D, here's what we should be taking?
Yeah. Again, and you called it definitely, it does depend, but generally taking a supplement, most people are likely deficient in magnesium. So that's a good one to look at. Vitamin D is another one. Vitamin D, the literature shows now that it's not just a vitamin, but it really does function in the body like a hormone does. It helps to build bones and muscles. It has anti-inflammatory effects. It makes enzymes and proteins that help prevent diseases and totally plays a role in aging and things like that, and the immune system. So vitamin D we get most readily from the sun. And so there are researchers, like, if you're interested in vitamin D, I'd look at Dr. Rhonda Patrick, is a big, big proponent of vitamin D. And she recommends that everyone be getting 5,000 IUs of vitamin D per day, which many of us, especially in places that are cloudier or in the winter, where many of us suffer from seasonal affective disorder, we want to be taking and supplementing with vitamin D. But for the rest of us, just getting outside and going on our daily walks, that is going to be a great way to get your vitamin D. And then just a couple others, you know, iodine is super important for a healthy functioning thyroid, especially nowadays. Many of us are having issues with hypo or hyperthyroid. Iodine we can find in seaweed, eggs, some types of fish, but yeah, you can certainly supplement with that. Vitamin B12 and iron, especially for our vegans and vegetarians, you can find those in organ meats, and generally just other sources of animal protein. And then I'd say probably the last two would be collagen and calcium, which we can find in boned fish, bone broth, which I'm a huge proponent of drinking bone broth for so many different reasons. But collagen and calcium, these are building blocks of skin and hair and bones and things like that. And those are going to help us in general with the elasticity of our skin and making sure that as we age, we're not going to be prone as much to breaking bones and different falls and things like that. Best bet for supplements is, first of all, getting tests done to determine what your individual needs are for your biochemistry and you know, your genetics and things like that. And then number two, just getting those micronutrients from whole food sources. That would probably be, I will get off my soapbox of supplements now, but that would be those are my recommendations there.
Those are great. Now, Arielle, if you could go back and encourage, inspire, or equip yourself as a child, what would you tell yourself?
Oh, I love that question. As a recovering perfectionist, I'd have to say, don't be afraid of a first draft. It's so naive to think that the first thing that comes out of your brain and onto paper is going to be something that can't be iterated on and can't be improved with just, you know, different tweaks and things like that. And so I've always been afraid of, or I have been afraid of getting something out there that's not perfect or that I don't want to have my name on to show to the world. And so, yeah, just there's no such thing as perfection. And let's say, what is that old saying, that perfect is the enemy of good. And so that, I think, is something that I've really come into in the last few years, especially as a business owner. And yeah, don't be afraid of that first draft.
I like that. Don't be afraid of that first draft. What a great quote. Now, for our listeners wanting to connect with you further, perhaps wanting to take part in your health coaching services, where can they connect with you?
So I have a free Facebook community called Fitness and Nutrition for Busy Professionals. And I actually host live workouts twice a week, every week. I started doing that at the beginning of the pandemic, I guess a year ago. And those workouts can be done from anywhere in the world, anytime. I make them accessible to everybody. And they're half an hour long. I usually do them on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So you can find that. The group is free, but it is a private group. So it's called, again, Fitness and Nutrition for Busy Professionals on Facebook. Otherwise, if you're looking to kind of get some lab work done and really get to the root cause of burnout or exhaustion or otherwise just health complaints that have eluded you for a really long time, I do offer free consultations to potential clients who are really serious about optimizing their health. So you can make an appointment with me on my website. It's just my first name and my last name.com, RELSILAGI.com. And I'm sure that you will link to that, Holly, yes, somewhere absolutely. Where they can
yes.
see that.
We'll make sure to put that all in the show notes for you listeners. So thank you so much, Arielle, for joining us today. We value your insight and clarity on so many things that have brought confusion in the past. And just thank you again for your willingness and your expertise in being here today, my friend. Thank you.
You're so welcome, Holly. It's been so fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me on this journey of life. I hope that today's highlight has been encouraging, inspiring, and equipping so you can go out and live your life full of purpose. I'd be honored if you'd take a moment to leave a review, or better yet, subscribe. We can also stay in touch by joining my email list at hollykirby.com. That's HollyCurby.com. Until next time, make it a great day for a great day.